You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, Philadelphia City Commissioner Lisa Dealey talks about the upcoming general election and concerns about voter suppression and even the potential for civil unrest. Also, Paul Robeson High School in West Philadelphia was on the verge of closure 7 years ago. Today, Robeson is a success story, and we will hear from Principal Richard Gordon, named America's Principal of the Year. To begin, the city of Philadelphia has reached a unique and potentially groundbreaking agreement with advocates for a large homeless encampment on a softball field along the Ben Franklin Parkway. As part of the deal, organizers of the encampment will establish a land trust. The city will then transfer ownership of 50 properties into the trust and will develop as well a pilot project for two tiny home villages. For its part, the encampment, a thorn in the side of the local community, is finally disbanding. The deal comes just a couple weeks after a smaller encampment at the Philadelphia Housing Authority headquarters also reached agreement with the city. We have two reporters joining us now to bring us more on this story. WHYY's Susan Phillips. Hello, Susan.
Hi, Mary.
And WHYY's Daryl C. Murphy. Hi, Daryl.
How you doing?
Well, thanks. So first question, how has a breakdown of the camp on the parkway been going? Susan?
Yeah, well, I was by there this morning. I mean, there's definitely still a lot of tents up. There is less people for sure, but it doesn't seem like it's completely been dismantled at this point. There's definitely a lot of people roaming around. There's some people picking up trash, but for the most part, you'll still see a lot of tents.
Susan, the encampment has been around, I think, about 4 months. There were several times the city issued eviction orders, but then backed away on enforcing them. As an observer, did you see the story ending this way with an agreement and then disbursement of those in the encampment?
You know, it was hard to know how it would end. I think the city was in a bind. They didn't want to use police and the encampment residents refused to leave because if you think about it, the residents themselves really had nothing to lose by staying there. And at one point I thought, well, the residents have nothing to lose and the city has nothing to give. So I was surprised that the city and PHA figured out how to meet the central demand of the residents, which was initially, you know, permanent housing. And the organizers really pushed for that. Now, some of them, you mentioned earlier about the houses that are going to be transferred.
Sure.
Obviously, a lot of them can't move into those houses right away because they're not in good enough shape to do so. So a lot of the residents ended up taking temporary shelter, you know, moving into shelters or other temporary housing situations. And that was a real compromise on their part. But I think in terms of the negotiations, they lasted a long time. They were constantly talking to each other. And I think one of the things that really helped regarding the organizers was that they really knew the complexity of the federal housing system's rules and regulations. So they would continue to push for concessions in the face of responses from the city and PHA, which basically said, well, we can't do that. And in the end, the city and PHA did figure out a way to do just that, which was transfer empty houses.
Yeah.
Of course, the people have to be gone from that site before that transfer starts to happen. And they definitely are not completely gone from that site yet.
Okay, we're going to talk, get into more detail about the agreements in just a moment. But Daryl, to you, Jennifer Benich is a frontline organizer involved with both camps. What did she have to say after agreements were won with the city?
Well, she expressed some happiness. You know, of course, maybe a little bit of sadness that, you know, the community is on the encampment is, you know, being dispersed. But she's ultimately happy about the opportunities that lie ahead for everybody. Mostly it's, you know, housing, of course, and also for some of them, there's going to be job opportunities. You know, and yeah, this was a hard-fought battle for them because, you know, there were multiple times the city tried to evict them, and they, you know, who knew what was going to happen, but they stood their ground, and, you know, months later, here we are.
Okay. And Susan, again, back to the deal in which the city transfers ownership of 50 properties to a nonprofit land trust. If I understand this correctly, the organizers actually put the trust together, and then the properties are transferred. Where are these properties located? Has that been determined yet?
Well, there are empty houses scattered throughout the city, and some the city owns and some PHA owns. PHA has about 4,000 what they call scattered site houses, which are used as affordable housing. And right now they have about 600 of them, according to PHA, that are not occupied. And a lot of these houses PHA acquired from the city in the 70s and 80s. And it's important to note that, you know, a few of them are habitable right now, because what happened at the encampment was, you know, as negotiations were going on, some of the residents actually started to squat some of these houses. But it's also important to note that many are not habitable and they need to be fixed up. So like you said, the organizers will have to form a community land trust, which is basically a nonprofit that will need to raise money, fix up the houses, and then essentially serve as a landlord to the tenants. And the deal with a community land trust is the houses will stay affordable forever. But there is a lot of work that needs to happen before that gets off the ground.
And according to PHA, there are 47,000 people on a waiting list for subsidized housing. How does this agreement with the encampments get around the long line of individuals and families waiting for housing?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's something that a lot of people are wondering about. I mean, it's important to note that a lot of the people at the encampment are on these lists, are on the list of 47,000 people, which hasn't taken anyone new in several years. But because the houses that are getting handed over are not slated to be given to anyone on that waiting list, it's basically not really jumping the queue. I mean, it's really complicated, but the houses being turned over, many, like I said, that need repairs, many of them would likely have been auctioned off by PHA to private developers. And that's a real issue that you heard over and over from the organizers, that federal housing policy essentially encourages PHA to sell homes in order to raise money that they need to use to repair other buildings, because there's this large, deferred maintenance. There's so much deferred maintenance on all these houses, not just the houses, but also the housing projects that PHA owns and operates. So what happens a lot is they auction off houses and private developers buy them. They typically knock them down and build, you know, higher end apartments or housing. Mm-hmm. And what the organizers will say is that in essence, this displaces the residents living in those original houses and also drives gentrification.
That was one of the main sticking points on the part of the organizers. Sure. Yeah,
exactly. And what the organizers will say is that it's more expensive to build a new house than to rehab an older one, so that the city and PHA should be rehabbing these houses.
Daryl, up until a couple of weeks ago, there was a much smaller but no less vocal encampment at the PHA headquarters called Camp Teddy. Tell us about the deal that was reached there.
So that deal was reached a couple of weeks ago on October 5th. It was a small encampment of about 15 or 20 people, and they were squatting on this construction site that PHA had planned for a multi-use, mixed-use development, pretty big project. And, eventually PHA and the encampment leaders came to the table and both agreed on transferring nine vacant houses to a land trust. So these were like some of the first properties to go into the land trust. And these nine properties are located in Strawberry Mansion, and they need a lot of work. And so part of the deal is that the encampment residents, they'll be able to work along the building trades union in rehabbing the projects, kind of creating some job opportunities there. And yeah, that's pretty much it. So they have these nine houses and, you know, these nine houses that need rehabbing, and they'll help in the rehabbing, you know. And it also, PHA says, like, you know, it creates an opportunity not only for work and stuff, but also to give people the sense of, you know, investment and ownership in these homes that, you know, they'll be living in.
And with the PHA camp closed, the way is now clear for a much anticipated redevelopment of the Sharswood, or in the Sharswood neighborhood. What will this look like, Daryl?
Well, it's a 234-square-foot mixed-use development. It's going to offer 98 housing units. Many of them are going to be below market rate. There's also going to be a grocery store, which is a big deal because, you know, many consider that part of the city to be a food desert, and there's not a lot of, like, you know, healthy food options, good quality food options. So they're going to have that. There's an urgent care, a bank, and even a restaurant is going to come there. It's a major piece in this 10-year, $500 million project to rebuild the Blumberg-Sharswood community that they started a few years ago. And, you know, one of the big points of excitement is, you know, in addition to this project bringing all these amenities and things to the neighborhood, is jobs, right? Like, you know, they're talking about 200 construction jobs and 200 permanent jobs for the people in the community.
Susan, back to the Parkway encampment agreement there. Part of it involves, the agreement involves implementing a pilot program to build two tiny house villages. So what would these tiny houses look like, and how many people might be able to live in each home?
Yeah, so tiny house villages is something that, you know, has been done successfully in places like Seattle and Austin. And essentially, they're wooden shelters. So instead of a tent, there's an actual wooden shelter with a door you can lock. It's about the size of a bedroom, and it has heat and electricity. They're more private and more secure than a tent. So they're a lot more, you know, the people who are unsheltered like them better than living in a shelter, for sure, in a congregate setting. And there's typically a shared bathroom and shared kitchen facilities. And I think the pilot project that they're talking about would house several dozen people.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds left. The encampments, you know, were not necessarily safe or clean spaces. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this segment, that, you know, the Parkway encampment was a thorn in the side, really, of the Logan Square Neighborhood Association. What has been the reaction of the association to the agreement there?
So I spoke to the president a couple days ago, and he's still pretty angry with Mayor Kenney. He says it should have not have gone on for this long, and that it should not have been allowed to grow. And he points the finger at the mayor for that. I think, you know, he's glad that it's, you know, slated to be dismantled. But I think a lot of the neighbors are still wary today about the deal because they can still see the tents up and the site, you know, and people at the site. So they're worried that some won't honor the deal.
All right. Thanks so much, WHYY Susan Phillips and WHYY's Daryl C. Murphy. Great to have you with us. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Stay with us as the regional roundup continues on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. There is growing concern that Philly could be a focal point of contention and even civil unrest on Election Day and in the days immediately following. The city of brotherly love was thrust into the national spotlight during the first presidential debate when President Trump stated, quote, bad things happened in Philadelphia, incorrectly claiming that Trump campaign poll watchers had been thrown out of satellite election offices. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign has recruited thousands of volunteers to monitor voting across battleground states, leading to fears of voter intimidation and suppression in places like Philadelphia. And there is concern that civil unrest could result from a potential blue shift in which Joe Biden catches up to and defeats Donald Trump days after Election Day. How is the city preparing, and what do Philly voters need to know? Questions or comments? Here's the number, 888-477-9499. Send an email to Radio Times at whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Philadelphia City Commissioner Lisa Dealey joins us now. Good to have you with us on the roundup, Lisa.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with a pressing question about mail-in ballots and the recent news that nearly 400,000 applications for mail-in ballots across the state have been rejected, in part because of often unwitting duplicate applications on the part of the voter. County elections offices are apparently swamped trying to handle questions from voters. How is this affecting Philadelphia County, if at all?
You know, just like all the other counties in Pennsylvania, we are dealing with that issue on a large number. So what we're asking Philadelphia voters who have received that message is to contact their office or give us a call, and we'll make sure that we get a resolution for you. If you're calling our office, we are the volume of calls to our office has just been unbelievable. So 311 has been helping us with the call volume. So if you call our office, you'll get 311. You might, if you leave a message, somebody will call you back from our staff that will be able to answer the question regarding your individual ballot.
Does this have the potential to suppress the vote?
You know, it does in a sense if people don't do anything further, right? Because, you know, people are like, I don't know what this is. I don't know why I got it. Just forget this. So that's why we appreciate the opportunity to be on, you know, the program this morning. So to tell people to just, you know, give us a call or get in touch with us by email, and we'll do what we can to make sure that you have a clear and concise answer to your individual ballot question.
Let's talk about the potential for voter intimidation in Philadelphia on Election Day. Tell us who is allowed to be in and around the polls in both an official and unofficial capacity when voters are present to cast their ballots.
So in Philadelphia, we elect our election boards. So they are allowed in the polls, you know, the people that work the tables. And a candidate or committee can have watchers that are assigned to them. But they are only allowed in there when there's nobody in the act of voting. And only people or persons in the act of voting are allowed in the polling place unless somebody's in there to provide assistance that is has been officially requested by the voter.
As the Trump campaign recruits poll watchers for battleground states, and of course Pennsylvania is one of those, and this is called a so-called army for Trump, are you concerned there could be intimidation at the polls in this regard?
You know, we want to make sure that everybody in Philadelphia can cast their vote in a safe and secure fashion. And we are, you know, as always, we work with the district attorney's office to make sure that people can do that in person, if that's how they so choose to vote, with no fear of intimidation. The district attorney's office has the district attorney's office has activated their task force early, and they will seek to prevent voter suppression and protect locations from potential violence across the city. And, you know, the district attorney's office will be out on the street dealing with that. The public is encouraged to report any possible criminal threats to interfere with their ability to vote by calling the district attorney's election task force hotline at 215-686-9641. And for any issues that occur inside the polling place, they can call our office at 215-686-1590, or they can let the judge of elections call us with the cell phone that is provided to every judge of election in all of our 1,703 divisions.
And Lisa, we'll post those numbers after the show is completed today. Thanks for those. Let's get to satellite election offices, you know, not polling places. Last month, the Trump campaign sent members to monitor some of the city's new satellite election offices. The monitors were not in, or allowed in, I should say, which caused some, you know, backlash from President Trump. What are the rules regarding such observers and election offices where voters apply for and can submit ballots?
So they are satellite election offices, and people are allowed in there that are requesting services from the Board of Elections. So they are for service. So those folks that are in there are in there for the purpose of obtaining service from the Board of Elections. Today, we are pleased to say that we 17 satellite election offices will be open today. The five newest additions will serve simply as drop-off locations where voters may submit their voted ballots, and they can also pick up applications, paper applications to fill out for voter registration, as today is the deadline in Pennsylvania for people to register to vote.
Okay. We have a question from Deborah, and I don't believe she's on the line. She's not on the line. But Deborah asks, Lisa, I read that Republicans will be trying to challenge signatures. On what grounds can mail-in ballots be challenged?
Those processes and procedures are still being determined. We will follow the law as it is in the election code, and there is actually a court case that's ongoing right now that we can't comment on with regard to signatures.
Let's talk about concerns over so-called naked ballots. If you're voting by mail in Pennsylvania, your ballot must be enclosed in a secrecy envelope, which is then placed inside an outer envelope before mailing. This is critical. The state Supreme Court has ruled that ballots not mailed in the secrecy envelope will be tossed out. We spoke with Secretary of the Commonwealth Kathy Buchfar last week, who says an enormous and very creative campaign to get voters to use both envelopes is underway. Lisa Dealey, are you satisfied with efforts to get the word out about this?
You know, I'm not, because I raised this concern early on before the court ruling. I had sent a letter to the legislature back in August, when I urged them to eliminate the secrecy envelope requirement for absentee and mail-in ballots. My arguments at that time were based on my hope that we could implement a more streamlined process in an effort to avoid voter confusion and to actually make it faster for us to be able to count these ballots, because now we have to do two processes. If we eliminated the secrecy envelope, that would eliminate a process. So even before this court ruling, you know, I had been campaigning on trying to get this secrecy envelope eliminated. But now, as we draw closer, and the rules have changed. So in June, in the primary, you know, remember, Pennsylvanians are voting for the first time this year by mail with no excuse.
Yeah.
So the very first time they did that was in June. And if they failed to use their secrecy envelope in June, we were permitted to count their vote. So if they, the rules have changed from June to November. So, I mean, that really doesn't seem fair, and it doesn't give us a lot of time to make sure that everybody's educated. So, you know, we'll just keep pushing and trying to make sure that we get the word out. I know the state is running a fantastic campaign around it. We've added it to our communications plan. And even the celebrities have certainly picked up the flag, and they're running with it also. So we're happy to have all these people helping us to be a voice and to get the message out. But I'm still concerned that we will still see quite a number of ballots that won't be counted because they didn't failure to use the secrecy envelope.
Okay. State House Republicans reportedly are considering allowing pre-canvassing, and you alluded to this just a moment ago. Counties would be able to start processing mail ballots ahead of Election Day. To be clear, Lisa Dealey, pre-canvassing is not counting. What does pre-canvassing involve?
Pre-canvassing allows us to get everything ready up until tabulation. So, look, we would like to see 21 days, but if we get 3 days, 3 days is better than nothing. But really, when you're considered, one thing we did learn in June, it takes a long time to count all those paper ballots. So any help we can get to get that process started early will go a long way to give people confidence in the count. So when it's taking you longer because, you know, you have hundreds of thousands of ballots that you have to sort and then open, and then you have to open another ballot. So it's a lot. So pre-canvass to be able to pre-canvass early would go a long way.
I believe the State House and Senate are back in session today, so I'm sure WHYY News will be following this story to see how that might develop. Ballot drop boxes. I was watching a TV news report last week about unofficial ballot drop boxes in California, which were set up by the state Republican Party there to collect ballots. California state officials say this is illegal and have issued a cease and desist order. Have you seen any such issues with ballot drop boxes in Philly?
We have not, but we have, the city commissioner's office has installed three 24-hour drop box locations installed for our voters, where voters can, from any part of the city, can return their own voted ballot. These drop boxes are accessible 24/7. They're located at City Hall on the South Broad apron, Riverview Place at 520 North Delaware Avenue on the Delaware Avenue side, and the Eastern State Penitentiary at 2027 Fairmount Avenue. Voters should remember that they may only drop off their own ballot unless the voter is physically unable to personally submit their own ballot and has designated an agent to deliver that ballot. And we intend to drop off more to deploy more drop boxes in the days ahead. So we encourage Philadelphia County residents and voters to visit our website at philadelphiavotes.com as the information will continue to be updated as more drop boxes are deployed.
My understanding is they're guarded 24/7 under video surveillance. Should they be guarded by a security person who's there in person to ensure ballot integrity and, you know, waylay any questions down the road?
They are guarded in accordance with the state's policies and procedures that have been set forth.
Okay. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. To the possibility of a blue shift election week, again, in which President Trump appears to be winning early on, but mail-in ballots, largely Democratic, eventually give the edge to Joe Biden. Observers have expressed concern about the potential for civil unrest. If this is thought on the part of Philadelphia City planning officials, what is being planned to address this possibility?
We are going to do everything that we can to get these votes counted quickly and accurately as possible. And we are, just like you, we're waiting to see if the legislature acts and does something that really costs $0 and would really go a long way in our ability to have these votes counted faster.
We are speaking with Philadelphia City Commissioner Lisa Dealey. The Inquirer reported on an election day planning session, which apparently happened last month, not open to the public, in which city officials discussed, you know, potential scenarios like the blue shift. This almost feels like a preparation for battle, Lisa, rather than an election. You were in office for the election of 2016. How have things changed, if they have?
I mean, things have changed. We are in a very different time. We are in a pandemic, but in 2016, you're right, I was here, and I remember then candidate Trump saying pretty much the same things. You know, there's going to be fraud in Philadelphia. They were going to send all these poll watchers to Philadelphia. We administered a free fair election in 2016 amid those similar charges. And rest assured, the 2020 election in Philadelphia will likewise be free and fair. We need to stay focused on our task at hand, which is to continue to provide Philadelphians a free, fair, and safe way to vote.
Are city officials concerned about the potential for cyber attacks, which could affect the integrity of Philly's voting machines or even spread disinformation?
We're just, you know, making sure that we are looking at any area where there may be a potential risk or threat of risk. And, you know, just doing our due diligence to make sure that our election remains free and fair and safe for all Philadelphians.
Okay. WHYY's Billy Penn is reporting that Pennsylvania's online ballot tracker is giving confusing answers to voters, checking the status of their ballots with, unclear word choices like pending or canceled. What does this mean, and what advice would you give to help navigate this?
You know, again, it's a hard situation because the Department of State is implementing with us this mail-in ballot with no excuse. The SURE system, which is the state's registration system, you know, it's dated, and it is not, you know, it is working, you know, at a capacity with all this, you know, influx of mail-in voting. So again, we're just asking voters to contact our office, visit our website. They can get the answers that they desire, but people should rest assured that if they have any issues, if they want any question answered, just give us a call or go to PhiladelphiaVotes.com, where you can find answers to many frequently answered questions. Most importantly, register to vote today before midnight and get your mail-in ballot in.
Want to squeeze in a question from Tim, who asks, can you, Lisa, please, his words, let us know how you plan to combat Republican efforts to disqualify as many votes as they can?
We are going to follow, you know, have policies and procedures in place. And, you know, a lot of that is going to, you know, we're just going to do what we always do. We're going to, any vote that is cast properly will be counted. And we just urge Philadelphians who are voting by mail for the first time to follow the instructions carefully that come with the ballot. And if you follow those instructions carefully, and you get your ballot back to us on time, filled out properly, your vote will be counted.
And this reminder again, today is the last day to register to vote, and October 27th is the last day to apply for a mail-in ballot in Pennsylvania, correct?
Correct.
All right, Philadelphia City Commissioner Lisa Dealey, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us with important information.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Up next on the regional roundup, we meet Richard Gordon of Paul Robeson High School in West Philadelphia. He is principal there, and he has just been named Principal of the Year, a nationwide honor. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. It's always nice to talk about good news, and so in case you haven't heard, 2020's Principal of the Year comes from West Philadelphia. Richard Gordon IV was among three finalists for the National Award and is largely credited for the sweeping change at Paul Robeson High School, taking it from the brink of closure to a school in which the vast majority of students graduate and many, if not most, go on to college. The president of the National Association of Secondary School Principals says, quote, Principal Gordon has led Robeson High School's extraordinary turnaround, keeping the success and well-being of his students as a top priority. Under his leadership, Robeson has been a model for other schools to follow. We are happy to have Richard Gordon with us for the remainder of the hour. Welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Richard, we must note that you were also named Pennsylvania's Principal of the Year in July. So how does it feel now to be given the national honor?
Unbelievable. Overwhelming. You know what? There are so many great leaders and principals here in the city of Philadelphia. So to be singled out by any organization is just an amazing thing. But I try to remind everyone that it's not about me. All the acknowledgments that have been coming our way have been really about the story of Robeson as a school community, as a school family. And it's just been an amazing journey these last 3 years. We've garnered about over 25 awards and accolades just starting in 2017 when we saw the most improved numbers start to come in. And so it's just been an amazing journey, to say the least.
So Paul Robeson High School, again, was in danger of closing 7 years ago, among the district's 30 lowest performing schools. Many staff and students were leaving at the time you walked in the door. Do you remember what went through your mind on day one?
Well, I could truly empathize with how the Robeson community was feeling during the course of that process. Prior to being at Robeson, I was actually the principal over at Roberts Vaux High School in North Philadelphia. And so our school closed. And that was an emotional experience going through that because nobody knew what was going to happen. The teachers were scrambling to try and find new locations to work. Students were being assigned to schools. They didn't get the opportunity to select where they wanted to go. And so it was a very traumatic transition. So when I got to Robeson High School, pretty much how the family, you know, my students were feeling at Vaux is exactly how the students and staff members were feeling at Robeson also. So as empathetic as I was, you know, I think that understanding made it a lot easier for us to kind of, you know, collaborate and be get on the same page fairly quickly.
Most of your students at Robeson live in poverty. How can poverty negatively shape the day-to-day educational experience for a young person?
Well, what I remind my staff members and even our families is that, you know, our students are dealt with, they deal with a lot of things. You know, a lot of our students are, you know, find themselves taking on a lot of adult responsibilities on a regular basis. And so when they do that, you know, they have other things that are more, you know, more priority than, you know, education. Sad to say, but unfortunately, that's just the reality that, that we're in. So my, you know, a student's reality may focus around, you know, how am I going to eat tonight? You know, so what's going on with my mom and you know, is she well? You know, especially if she's in the hospital and I have to lead the household. There is so many factors that happens. And so if students are the ones who are unfortunately have to take up the responsibility a lot of times in their households, you know, with taking on jobs to make ends meet, to raise children, that are the siblings, you know, those things really impede on a student's focus on education. So those are just some examples of what happens with a lot of our students. And so, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead, finish up.
So I was just saying that, you know, those things, unfortunately, you take the focus off of, you know, their education, you know, so unfortunately, it starts to affect their attendance, their grades, and really starts to limit their options on what they want to do beyond high school. So we have to consider those things when we're planning programming around students so we can support them as best we possibly can.
So what are some of the answers?
Well, I don't know if I have the answers. But the one thing I can tell you that has definitely worked is that we invest a lot in prevention, a lot in relationships, and really a lot in how, you know, in the question of how do we get students to really love the aspect of coming to school every single day. And so we find that students love coming to school every day because they have those connections. They know that they're going to be cared for. They know that there are going to be resources and program supports that are going to be of interest to them. They know that we're going to try and do our very best to personalize those things so that we can spark their passions so that not only are we thinking about how they're going to be successful now, but also how are they going to be successful in the future. And so those things have to be very personal and personalized for our students so that we can make sure that what we're trying to offer them at Robeson and really at many of the schools in the Philadelphia public school system to make them make education a higher priority in their lives.
How has the pandemic impacted your effort to get students to love coming to school when I'm guessing most, if not all, are online?
Well, that's been a little more challenging, as you can imagine. And so, one of the things that we wanted to make sure, again, we stick to our core values and our core values focusing around making those connections and those healthy, nurturing relationships, and that we make sure that our schedule allows for that to happen. So we have an extended advisory period of time. We also have after school time that we just allow students to connect with us, to talk with us, to have time to just, you know, review what's going on, not only with their lives, but also with their academics. We use our Fridays as an opportunity for kids to engage in, you know, personal interest activities. There are some students who are interested in attending college courses with some of the university partnerships that we have. There are some students who are very much into workforce development opportunities where they get a chance to do a lot of skill building and a lot of, you know, entrepreneurial work with some of our partners as well. So we just try to make things as interesting and as personalized as possible and while at the same time making sure that we're investing our time into getting closer to them, always knowing who they are, knowing what's going on with them, and giving them every opportunity to express, you know, how they're feeling and what they're thinking about each and every day.
And do you find during this challenging time, during the pandemic, that most of your kids at Robeson are responding, or are you concerned, as so many principals across the country are, that some kids are slipping through the cracks because of this?
Well, if one student slips through the cracks, we're definitely concerned. And so, again, I've been so appreciative of the amazing team that I have in place right now, who makes every effort to make sure that they are reaching out, either if they're the student advisor or if they're just, you know, have the student for a particular class that they're teaching, and they make every effort to reach out to their family, to reach out to that student, set up meetings, just phone calls, conversations as much as possible to see what's going on. So we find that the majority of our students are responding well. We do have several families, of course, that we're truly concerned about, but we're going to continue to make every effort and continue to fight through this. This is not something that any of us cares for. I remind our students and our families all the time, we don't like it either. We hate the virtual situation, the overall circumstance, but we also know that this is also the time that we absolutely, as a community, have to band together. And if we continue to band together, we know for a fact that we can get through this together successfully. And so we're finding that's a foundation for us.
Richard Gordon, I've read that, a lot of people at Paul Robeson High School have your cell phone number and that you've been in touch with a lot of kids. So, stressful situation across, across the landscape as far as the pandemic is concerned, is for you and your staff. So how do you find the energy and the emotional bandwidth to be present in this way for so many kids?
Well, it's something that I've like to believe that I've been doing for the majority of my career. And so I think that when I think about the students at Robeson in particular, I'm just so amazed at the things that they go through and the things they have to overcome and the things that they're willing to deal with to still balance getting a solid education and doing everything that we're asking them to do. And they step up to the challenges. And I think that, you know, if our students are dealing with all of that, then we need to make every effort to make sure that we are in a position to be available to them and support them. And, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to ensure that our students and our teachers are as successful as possible. And so I think that that's been really my own personal motivation. And so that willingness has really pushed me to make sure that, you know, I always do have that energy, have that drive, that push. And so if that means that I have to address some things with families and students on the weekends or evenings, it happens. And then at the same time, I'm watching my staff also have that same drive. I just had one of my teachers with some students who had missed a few classes, unfortunately, due to conflicting schedules. And she held a lesson in the middle of Malcolm X Park in West Philadelphia with three students on her own. You know, she asked me for permission to do it. And I said yes. And they had a makeup session in the park.
Wow.
just to make sure that the students were all caught up in their work. I was so amazed.
That's just terrific. Yeah,
it's amazing. Like, so to really have people in place who truly believe what you believe and then them taking the initiative to make it happen, those are the things that motivate us each and every day to make sure that we're doing the best for our students.
Richard Gordon, you are quoted as saying, "My kids are academic in this building and we're nice to each other every single day." So whether you're in the brick and mortar scenario or you're online, there's probably not a school in the country that hasn't had to deal with bullying at some point. How do you build a culture of kindness?
Well, again, it goes back to those relationships and those connections, but also I'm directly involved as much as I possibly can. I think it's important that as staff members that we set, that we model and we set the standard in our building. I think that it's important as we're setting that standard, as we're setting the model, that we also teach our students the importance of using our words and not our emotions. And so my conference table in my office is often utilized for peer mediation. That mediation happens sometimes, with staff members present. Sometimes it happens where students come in and they ask for that opportunity to sit down and have a talk. And we encourage that. So we really encourage our students, making sure that they are having every opportunity for student voice in the building. and that they have open, you know, we have an open door policy with all of us, whether it's myself, whether it's my leadership team, or whether it's teachers in general. And so those things have really made it very comfortable for students to be able to come and express not only what's happening, but also letting us know in advance some things that might be happening that we can get ahead of. And like I said earlier, we invest a lot of time in prevention to make sure that we can deal with those issues before they even blow up out of control.
What makes for a terrific teacher? And if you spot a young person who has the qualities to make a good teacher, do you actively try to steer them in that direction?
Well, I do. And so I'm amazed that when we have a few students who talk about the idea about being a teacher, because they are so motivated by the teachers we have in place. And so I think that what makes a great teacher is somebody who's not only obviously kind and cares about, you know, about working with children, but also making sure that they're also someone who really is open to learning and understanding that it's important to be a great team member. I often say, you know, with anybody I speak with, I can teach you how to teach. I can't teach you how to get along with kids. And so you have to have those, you know, interpersonal skills that are very important to connect with our students, because our students really allow us to teach them. Education has changed. And so maybe 30, 40, 50 years ago, you know, students would do what you would ask them to do because, you know, you were the adult in the room. You know, now so much, it's not so much the case anymore. And so now we have to make sure that we are making those connections so that we can motivate students to, you know, accept what it is that we have to offer.
This
and
is,
so,
oh, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. All right. No, that's fine.
Quick break here. This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. So Richard, in your opinion, are there enough young people of color pursuing teaching as a profession?
No, I don't think there's enough. But I think that there are some relational things that absolutely have to be addressed in order to, you know, increase those numbers too. Because a lot of this, again, I often say that I am the students that I serve. You know, I grew up in Camden, New Jersey. I grew up impoverished, and I also grew up with great opportunities to have a mother who was very determined for me to be successful. I also had connections with individuals at school who really wanted to look out and make sure that I was considering all of my options. And I think that, you know, even growing up in poverty, I understand the importance of why this issue has to be addressed. Because I think that once we start the idea of starting to address, you know, the issue of poverty, not just in Philadelphia, but of course around the country, it will also open up the opportunity and the possibilities to facilitate more students going to college and considering a career in education so that we can continue to, you know, improve the circumstances of having quality education for everyone.
Robeson has built some important partnerships with entities like Penn and Drexel. What do they offer the kids?
So one of the things I've noticed, you know, in my time as principal is that sometimes dual enrollment, for example, can be very limited because there is a cost factor to it all. And so one of the things that we did with the universities is that we began to take a look at opportunities for college courses to be taught. And so even though we weren't able to offer dual enrollment, we were still able to offer those college courses through the universities, and students were able to get high school credit for them. And then the opportunities for those classes provided the opportunity for students to have the college experience, to determine whether or not they truly wanted to go to college, and they had an opportunity to do a lot of the, you know, pre-college work to determine that. So those are great opportunities that Drexel, CCP, Penn have all offered our students, and we continue to expand those opportunities into a number of areas. I think today we're starting archaeology, which is kind of crazy.
I'm going to have to stop you there. Unfortunately, we're just about out of time, but exciting things happening at Paul Robeson High School in West Philadelphia. Richard Gordon, the principal and principal of the year, thank you so much for joining us. Great speaking with you.
You as well. Thank you so much for having me. And again, thank you on behalf of the entire Robeson community.
And don't forget, we are here for you on social media. Visit us at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Adam Stanishevsky. Our producer, John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us. Be well.